are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to tonight's stream. We're live on Odyssey, we're live on Rumble, and we are live on Entropy. Please do share the links. We've got a big stream. We've got a lot of things to discuss. And I think it's going to be a good stream, because I was going to talk about this on Patriotic Weekly Review earlier in the week. However, it was a stream with Adam Green, and me and Adam ended up debating sort of issues about what was more damaging to white people. My contention was it was the media, the American establishment, the banking system, and Adam's contention was it was essentially Christianity was the big problem. We had a bit of a debate, and we didn't really get into the nuts and bolts of what's happening at the moment in terms of this economic apocalypse, as I've called it. And, you know, things are getting pretty grim for people. So I thought I'd do a special stream on this. And people seem to really enjoy the stream I did the other week with Natty and Euro. Now, Natty can't make every Friday. He's got a young family. But Euro can make more dates. So I was speaking to Euro early in the week. I asked him to come on, and here he is. So do give the stream a share if you can. We're going to fill in some of the gaps we missed out on Wednesday. Now, if you can, if you like the streams, if you like the work I do, if you support the work I do, please do consider giving a small donation. It really, really helps. And if people don't donate to the shows, obviously, I don't then get to make a living, and I don't get to do as much work as I'm doing. I really do appreciate it when people do make donations. You can donate through Entropy, you can donate directly through Rumble, and everything is very, very gratefully received. So if you do like my work, please do consider making a small donation. Nothing I've ever done has gone behind a paywall. So if you want to give $3, $5, $10, whatever you can afford, and you can donate as well when I'm not online. So if you want to donate now live through the show, me and Euro will answer any questions after the main presentation, and we'll read out all the super chats. But if I'm not online and you think I've been doing a really great job and you like what I do, please do consider giving a small token of your appreciation, or more if you can afford it. Obviously, if you can afford to give more and you want to, I appreciate that too. You can also donate via cryptocurrencies. All the cryptocurrencies are in the description below. So if you want to donate via Bitcoin or Monero or anything like that, you can do. And finally, if you want to write to me, you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. So again, if you can donate, I would really, really appreciate that. Anyway, we've got a lot to discuss tonight, and we're going to be talking about this looming economic crisis, which is all being built off the back of this completely unwanted and illegal war in Iran that was started by Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. You know, the Judeo-American Empire is at it again. And yet again, they want to drag as many Western nations into this conflict as possible, which is something we want to avoid. And obviously, so far, Britain hasn't got involved, which is good. And we hope to keep it that way. And it's heartening as well to see other European nations such as Spain decline to get involved, which, again, puts Israel and America at odds with Europe. And they're out on a bit of a limb at the moment, which is, again, a good thing, because as I've stated numerous times, as I stated on Wednesday, I believe the Judeo-American state is the greatest threat to not only white people, but the whole world. Anyway, before we get into the stream, let's say hello to Euro. Euro, it's good to have you here tonight, my friend. How are you doing? Have you had a good week?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. You know, doing well. Week's been good, and the weather's finally turning out a bit nicer than it's been for a long time. So getting some sun in. Might even do some gardening this weekend.
I did some gardening earlier in the week. I think I was telling you about this the other day. I moved about half a ton of manure and put it into my raised beds, but I think I needed another half ton to get things filled up. But there was plenty of worms in it, so I'm looking for good quality soil and good quality plants, as in crops. So I'll be growing some vegetables again this year with the family, which I'm looking forward to. Enjoyed doing that last year, and I installed my own raised beds, and I'm keeping the garden going. Although it is always really disappointing because you get a really great lawn and then winter comes and kind of trashes it, and then you have to build it back up again, which is kind of annoying, but it's all part of being a family man, I suppose. Anyway, let's get into this issue, because that's what we were here for. That's what the audience are here for. And I think the first thing to say is the Iran war is not going to plan, or it's not going to the plans of Donald Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu, and Pete Hegseth. It doesn't seem to be going their way. Now, I'll say this. I'm not one of these people who's going to say Iran is winning. Now, I know there are some white nationalists out there who are doubling down and, yeah, Iran's winning, America's losing. I wouldn't go that far. I've likened this war a little bit to like a boxing match where you have a plucky underdog boxer who is performing far better than anyone thought he would. And he's not only still on his feet in rounds two and three when he was meant to get knocked out in the opening minute of round one, but he's throwing the odd punch back, which is actually causing significant problems for the boxer that was meant to win. This was meant to be a walkover. It was meant to be, you know, a formularity, you know, another step down the road for the favourite, an easy step down the road. But instead, the underdog is still in there. And yep, he's taking some heavy beatings, but he's still on his feet and he's still fighting back. And I think that's impressive. And some people might say, well, that's a win in itself to sort of survive this long against American might. And, you know, the American military is the not the biggest, but it is the best funded military in the world by a long way. Now, I think it's damn impressive that Iran is still fighting back. And not only is Iran still fighting back, but Iran is fighting back in a way that is creating the maximum number of problems for both America and the Western world, and also for Middle Eastern countries who are allowing America to host bases on their soil. So countries that are being used as staging points for attack on Iran are also suffering. And interestingly, one thing that we do seem to see from this is a complete disconnect from the rulers of these Arab countries that are allowing America to use their land for bases, and the people of those countries who seem to be cheering on the attacks on those American bases and seem quite happy for Iran to be fighting back against Israel and America. So, Euro, obviously, you've seen this unfolding. Iran seems to be hanging in there. And despite the initial strikes, which seem to decapitate the leadership, the regime, and I know you hate the word regime, I shouldn't have used that word, the Iranian leadership is, or what's left of it, is holding strong. They're fighting back. They're still in there. How do you see this at the moment? Do you see this as an Iranian victory for them just to be still on the battlefield at this point?
Well, they have a very different win condition than the Americans or Israelis do. So them surviving as a nation in control of their own destiny would be a victory in and of itself. But the fact that they are inflicting damage, physical and economic damage, upon America, upon its bases in the region, and especially on the Zionist entity in Palestine as well, you know, that's just even better. So I think they would definitely say that they are winning. And that you know, it's not going to be the case that they're going to drop any weapons on the continental US, but just surviving in their current form and doing the sort of damage they are, that's a victory for them. And we don't know quite what damage they've been able to do to Israel because of all the heavy censorship. We do know that they've done huge damage to the American bases in the region, and also the aircraft carrier, which was having a massive problem with its toilets previously, just so happened to purely by chance have a giant fire, which the Americans say was not caused by the Iranians shooting missiles at it. But how likely is that really?
Well, it's either been caused by the Iranians shooting missiles at it, or it's self-sabotage because the crew members don't want to go to war and don't want to be used as potentially a sacrifice, which is a very interesting theory that was being put forward by a number of different sources. But I think the issue here with this war not going to plan for Trump is it's immediately caused a number of issues for him within his own establishment. We've seen the resignation of Joe Kent. We've seen Pete Hegseth having a couple of meltdowns and declaring his undying loyalty to Trump. We've even seen a little bit of a falling out between Trump and Netanyahu. And Trump has even rebuked Israel for some of their attacks, which have actually affected gas production in the region. Because, I mean, Israel just doesn't care, does it? I mean, at this point, Israel is happy to just cause as much chaos and destruction as they can. They'll kill as many civilians as they can. It doesn't matter. You know, these people are war criminals. They're horrible human beings. But although the Israelis seem to be doubling down, I do think one of the interesting things is the Trump establishment looks more fragmented than ever before. What do you think to that? And what do you think to the resignation of Joe Kent?
Well, it's good to see somebody with some principles who's willing to go out there and say what's actually going on, regardless of who does win this war or the material conditions at the end of things. It's undeniable that there's a huge amount of waking up going on. You know, people who we would never think would come out and talk about these things can clearly see this is Israel, this is Jewish power running the show, and they're coming out and saying it. So, you know, that's always a positive thing. Obviously, Donald Trump declared himself previously to be the king of the Jews. He is very much on their side, and some say a pawn, but others say more of a willing participant. He doesn't want to do things that are going to destroy his own credibility and reputation. I think it really is just a case of the Jews who reside in America understand that if they push this too far, it's just over for them. And the Jews who reside in Israel understand that this is kind of their last chance. You know, their best chance would have been a decade ago, but every day the chances get less and less for them to dominate Iran. So they had to do something, you know, and so they're both trying to achieve the same thing. But obviously Trump and his allies in America, they don't want to destroy things so utterly that it's going to cause more of a backlash against Jewish power. One thing that you did mention in the beginning, which I should have brought you up on then, is you said we're not involved. Now, we're not actively involved in the sense of dropping weapons on the Iranians, but we are actively involved in a number of ways. For example, along with many other European countries, we're providing missile defense. So we're flying our fighter aircraft in order to use their missiles to try and intercept projectiles that are coming towards Israel. But actually, we're also directly allowing American warplanes to use our bases as staging areas and takeoff points for bombing runs into Iran, which other countries such as Spain have explicitly disallowed. So we are more involved than most. And although there were previously reports that the Iranians had struck our base in Cyprus, and then that was said to be some kind of false flag operation, they would certainly be justified in some senses in attacking British assets, because we are actively engaged in helping the Americans and Israel in this genocidal war.
Yeah, that's a fair point and a fair correction. I've just been looking on the news about the Pete Hegseth outburst. I mean, the fact that he has gone to the press, and despite Donald Trump doing everything he can to staff or stuff the Pentagon with yes men and people who will spout whatever narrative he tells them to spout, to see Pete Hegseth having this meltdown, shouting at reporters, accusing the nation of having Trump derangement syndrome, calling reports of America failing to topple Iran as fake news, I think it's quite hilarious. And it reminds me somewhat of Pam Bondi's meltdown when she had to testify in front of Congress. And it does seem that Trump has surrounded himself with these sycophants. And when push comes to shove, the only thing they can do is publicly essentially tell the world how much they love Donald Trump and what a great job he's doing in a desperate attempt to hold on to their role. I think some of this is because they fear potentially when Trump goes that they will face some kind of repercussions, and they're looking for one of these pardons afterwards. But how do you feel about the Trump establishment looking so shaky? Because to have the resignation of Joe Kent, then to have a situation where Trump has become more and more isolated, you're seeing far, far less of the people around Trump that you were when he went after Maduro in Venezuela. The gaggle of people seems to have thinned right down to just Pete Hegseth. And he is looking more and more isolated, more and more blustery. He has had a war of words with Netanyahu. I don't think anything will come of that. But this doesn't seem like a group of people who are either A, united, B, have the backing of serious players around them, or really have a grasp of the implications of what they've got themselves into. This does look like chaos already. And from an Iranian point of view, yes, many of their leaders have been killed, but they do look far more unified than Trump's own establishment. And certainly the American people, I would say, are mainly against this. And this is really hurting Trump.
Yeah, it's hurting Trump, definitely. But this is his last term, so to an extent, he doesn't care beyond his own ego and beyond the lasting ramifications for the Epstein class that he's a part of. So the other thing with Pete Hegseth that you mentioned is previously they were talking about him putting these fanatical Christian Zionists into the military structure, who were just going out and telling soldiers, oh, this is the end times. You know, a lot of blood is going to be spilled so we can bring about the second coming. And of course, that will be some kind of redirection that they want to be able to use when this all goes terribly wrong, and they can say, oh, look, it wasn't Israel, it was these fanatical Christians who wanted this war. It's very telling as well that JD Vance has pretty much been hiding this entire war, you know, not because he thinks he's going to get killed by a bomb, but just because he doesn't want to be seen to be part of it if he's going to have any chance of becoming president. And I think it's kind of a sure thing now that at the next election you're going to have a Democrat running America, but they're still going to be Zionists, because that power structure that extends over both parties is still in place. You know, unless you have a real outsider, somebody who comes in like Trump, but, you know, not like Trump in many ways, unless you can have a real outsider come in and lead things, you're just going to get another Zionist, but you're going to get maybe a more careful Zionist who wants to go about things in a different way. So ultimately, it's not really going to change it will change in the sense that they won't be as willing to go out there and do things so openly. But so many people are going to be more on the lookout for this. There's people we would never have imagined are coming out and saying, yep, it's the Jews, this is a Jewish war, and they're going to have to be a lot more careful with the next regime that leads America.
I think that's an amazing point, actually, Euro, and it's something that I was getting at, but you named probably the most important name, because during this second term, Trump has been almost joined at the hip with J.D. Vance. Vance has been with him, very supportive. But during this issue, Vance has been essentially muted and was very, very diplomatic on the Joe Kent resignation, which will probably have angered Trump, because he will be looking for people like Vance to step forward and savage those who aren't completely behind the war. But you can see that even the closest to Trump, not sort of the war hawkish sort of Jews like Mark Levine and apparently Laura Loomer, who's now getting personal calls from Trump so that she can praise him, because he loves nothing more than being praised. But I do find it incredible that the actual serious elected people around him are now backing away. The rumors are that Tulsi Gabbard might be the next to resign. And it's kind of funny, because in Trump's first first run as president, he seemed to have a situation where he was constantly sacking people. He was constantly sacking his own team to often please the media or to please different factions. And he struggled in that sense. This time, he's built a team around him that looked far more solid. But this decision to attack Iran, rather than leading him to sack people, his own team are deserting him. And it does look chaotic when you're constantly sacking people, but it looks far more chaotic when people are resigning and when you look at a room and your closest allies aren't willing to be in that room with you. So that's an excellent point. Now, the other thing about Trump, which I think we can't understate, is Trump was meant to be not just a guy that dealt with immigration, but he was meant to be this guy who understood the economy. He understood money. He understood how things worked. And I think a lot of normal, white, middle-class Americans looked at Trump and said, this is a guy who will get things working. This is a guy who's going to put America on top, look after our interests. And because Trump's this rich guy, because he's this New York property owner, businessman, investor, and that's what he was built up as. I mean, he was a famous guy, and he was a guy that for many years was almost seen as the man that embodied the American dream, and a tycoon, a successful all-American tycoon. So these people would have been thinking, well, if anyone's going to get the economy back on track, it's a business-minded man. And this is where the real disaster begins. Now, the obvious issue here is your petrol and your diesel prices, or as Americans call it, gasoline and kerosene. But when you look at fuel prices at the pump, they have risen significantly. Prices of crude oil have surged between 50 and 60%, climbing from about $72 a barrel right up to $119 a barrel. We've seen jet fuel almost doubling in price, rising from $830 per ton to over $1,500 per ton. The price at the pump of regular gasoline rose 20% in America from $2.98 a gallon to $3.58 a gallon. Diesel in America jumped by 28%. This is huge. And there's regional peaks in places like California that have exceeded $5 a gallon due to heavy reliance on imports. Now, we've seen similar things in the UK. It's not just America that's been hit hard. Diesel in the UK is up by 20.3p a litre, which is a 14% increase. And petrol has had a 7.4% increase, up by 9.8p a litre. So now at the pump, diesel here in the UK is £1.63 a litre, and petrol is £1.43 a litre. I'm not sure if these are all-time highs, but they're certainly pushing it. And we know the same is true in places like Australia, New Zealand, and elsewhere in Europe. Now, what for normal working families, things like the price of petrol are really, really important, because you drive your kids to school, you go to the shops in your car, you commute in your car. And really, it's fair to say, especially in the UK, the entire system of travel has been rerouted from public transport to personal motor vehicles. And now we're in a situation where fundamentally, normal people are going to be priced out of using their car. And at a time when the economy isn't in the best shape, at the time when we're already seeing rapid inflationary pressures, which are making the basket of goods at the supermarket more and more expensive every week, this hike in petrol prices, I think it's really going to hit normal people hard. And again, this is something you wouldn't expect, or the MAGA voters wouldn't expect from a Trump presidency. How do you feel about this euro, and how do you think this is going to affect normal people, both in America and Europe?
Yeah, it's definitely going to affect normal sort of working and middle class people more than anyone else. And you're right, public transportation in the UK is, in some places it's okay, but in other places it's just not very good at all. We have the most expensive trains per mile anywhere in Europe. If you get on a bus, you're likely to be cohabiting with racial strangers who at the best play their music too loud, and at the worst may murder you for no reason other than they felt like it and they hate you for your race. You know, as we saw in other such cases, like Irina Zarutska, just casually murdered because someone didn't like the look of her. So public transport in the UK, it's dangerous, it's unpleasant, it's expensive. So people are forced to use their own cars. And if we look at cities, obviously, from myself, I know a bit about London, but I'm sure it's the same for many cities around the country. Where they have diversified cities, they've brought in large populations of racial strangers. You have these people kind of in the centre or a ring around the centre, and you have commuters. The white people have fled the centres of cities. They've gone to the outskirts where they can try and buy a property at a reasonable price and raise a family. And they commute into the central areas of cities to work. So they're the ones most affected by the rising cost of fuel. But as well as that, you're right, we do have these other pressures going on. We've had over the past couple of years massive increases in the price of food. And partially that is because of, price shocks related to the war in Ukraine and the decision to sanction Russian fuel exports, which just makes it more expensive to transport everything. But also they produce large amounts of fertilizers. So the price of food going up, the price of fuel going up. And I know it's kind of jumping ahead a bit as well, but one of the ways that the government might try and keep down inflation is to raise interest rates. But people still need to buy fuel. There's only so much discretionary travel that you're doing in your own car. Most of it is going to be to get to and from work and to go to the shops to buy the food that you need. This is going to massively affect, as I say, white commuters who've been ethnically cleansed from the center of their own towns. And especially, like, imagine if you are a white van man who works in construction as like a plumber or an electrician or something, and you're driving around to different sites during the day, you're in your own van, the price of diesel's gone up, you try to feed your family, the price of food is going up, you try to pay your mortgage is going up, everything, absolutely everything, is going up and up and up, and you're just getting squeezed from both ends.
Well, that's how I think normal people are going to feel on this, because obviously people talk about petrol and diesel prices going up, and the immediate thought is, how much is it going to be on my tank of fuel? So if I'm going to fill my tank up, was that going to be 50 quid a week ago, and next week it's going to be 60 quid? Will it be 70 quid next week? How much am I putting in per week? Was I spending 200 quid on fuel over the month, and now I'm going to be spending 240? And will it be 280 in a month's time? These are concerns that normal people have. But our economy runs on fuel now. So at one point, people would walk to the village shops, they'd cycle to the village shops. I remember my grandma and granddad, they never had a car. They cycled everywhere. They'd cycle to the shops. People don't do that anymore. And importantly, food gets to the shops because of petrol and diesel. Everything we use in the modern world, well, not everything, but many of the things we take for granted in the modern world are actually derivatives in some way of oil, crude oil. Crude oil is used, it is broken down and used in so many processes. And if you disrupt that supply, or you increase the cost of crude oil, especially significantly, it doesn't just affect the price of you driving to the supermarket, it affects the price of almost every good on the shelf. Every item you put in the basket is affected. And we've already seen these incredible inflationary pressures over the last 12 months. People have been talking about how much normal things are. And look, I know I bang on sometimes about the same things. And I bang on about Red Bull. I like a Red Bull. Well, I remember when a single can of Red Bull was about 95p a can, maybe less. Now, a can of Red Bull for a 250ml can is all the way up to 175 per can. The medium-sized 355ml can is now £2.20. That's gone up by 10p in the last few weeks. Now, I know you might say, well, what's 10p on a can of Red Bull? But if it's 10p on a can of Red Bull and 10p on a box of eggs and, you know, 40p on, you know, a cut of meat. And I was speaking to the wife earlier, and she was saying, you know, there's a lot of red meat left on the shelves these days in the supermarket because people can't afford it. But the chicken aisle is empty every day because chicken is now by far the most affordable meat. This is affecting normal people, and normal people are feeling the pinch. But it's not just feeling the pinch in one direction. People are feeling the pinch from multiple different angles, because this is also having a huge effect, not just because of the crude oil, but because of natural gas prices. And the heating and home fuel prices are also rising dramatically. And again, this is going to further squeeze people. Now, the increase on household energy prices have been incredible. Now, the headline news has been what's called home heating oil that is used in more remote parts of the UK, sort of rural Scotland, northern Scotland, rural parts of Northern Ireland, parts of Wales and remote parts of England, has more than doubled in the last month. So those on the, you know, in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland that run their house on heating oil are seeing the price of that double. So the price of heating their homes has doubled in the last month. And the UK energy price cap has gone through the roof. People are predicting that the average energy price cap will increase by about 20%. So that's going to rise by well over £300 for the average household And that's going to come into force very, very soon. So the average household is going to have to find another more than £300 a year to heat their home. And those using heating oil, well, if their bill was £1,000 last year, it's going to be £2,000 this year. So we're seeing this problem of people spending more money just to get to work, more money on a basket of goods at the supermarket. People are having to make cutbacks. They're really struggling. But then on top of all of that, they're going to have serious problems heating their homes. And I think what we're seeing here is, like I said, it's not just being squeezed from one direction. It's not like somebody poking you from one direction. It's like multiple people poking you from every direction, and you're feeling the squeeze in every way. And for normal families that were already struggling with inflation, I think this is going to be a turning point, because at some point, the average working family, well, we've already hit a point in the UK where on average now, more households take more in benefit. So we've reached this tipping point where now the majority of households in the UK claim more in benefits than they pay in taxes. And at some point that becomes unsustainable. And for the families that are being taxed and that are paying into the system, they are going to have less and less money. Those are the people that are going to be the squeezed the hardest, because they're paying out in tax. They've got children. They've most likely got two motor vehicles on the drive. Mum and dad both go to work. They have to turn the heating on in the morning because they don't want the kids to be cold. They've got to fill that trolley with groceries every week to feed their family. Things are going to get tougher and tougher for the average working person. And that kind of middle band of people that have kept society afloat, both in America, the UK, and I'm sure elsewhere in Europe, these are the people that are now going to be really, really suffering. What's your thoughts on that, mate?
Yeah, I had meant to mention the heating as well. But yeah, of course, like I say, it's going to be the white van man with, you know, fueling up his van to get around to work, trying to feed his family, heat the home, and then pay his mortgage. He's just going to be absolutely decimated. He's going to say, I can't afford to go to the pub anymore. So he won't go to the pub. All the pubs are going to shut down. He'll stay at home instead and turn on the telly, and he'll be bombarded with anti-white propaganda all day instead. And as bad as it is for the working people with families, white pensioners in this country, I mean, overwhelmingly, pensioners in this country are white British, and they were already struggling. They were already, you know, in some cases saying, I have to choose heat or eat. I can't do both. And it's just that even more so. You are going to see so many pensioners dying off as this gets worse and worse. And I think something like 35% of power generation in the UK is natural gas. So even if you have one of these new build homes where they don't even let you have a boiler and everything's electric, you've got the electric hob and you've got the electric heating, the price of your electricity is going to shoot up massively as well. You know, it's not just for the fuels. It's going to be a disaster, and people are going to be in the streets before too long if this continues.
But you know what's interesting as well, mate, is this all is compounded. Well, maybe not compounded, but comes on the back, or is compounding an already existing problem, because this all comes on the back of the conflict in Ukraine. Now, obviously, when the conflict in Ukraine began, it was more or less started by America sabotaging the Nord Stream pipeline. And what saw the initial surge in natural gas prices in Europe was America's attack on Russia's ability to supply natural gas to Europe. And for a long period of time, countries like Germany and other countries in Europe had benefited massively from cheap Russian gas. Now, I know you're not a football fan, and I'm not a massive football fan, but I remember for a long period, the UEFA Champions League, for those living outside of football-playing nations, the Champions League is essentially the highest level of football league in the world. It's where the best European club teams every year take each other on in what is first a group tournament, then a knockout tournament, to crown the champion of Europe. And it's usually teams that win it, teams like Barcelona and Real Madrid. It's a big thing. And that used to actually be sponsored at one point by, I believe it was a company called Gazprom, which was or is a natural gas. Yeah, Gazprom, a natural gas distribution company, which is Russian majority state owned. And they used to actually sponsor Europe's most prestigious football tournament. This was a normal thing. It was very, very normal, very, very regular to see open displays of Russia supplying Europe with its gas, and everyone was happy with this. Now, obviously, when the American State Department triggered the conflict in Ukraine and when sanctions were placed on Russia, this caused major hardship in parts of Europe. Energy prices surged, particularly in Germany, which was extremely reliant on Russian natural gas and, to a lesser extent, Russian oil. And Russian oil was something that at one point was very, very readily available. It was very cheap. Russia is obviously the largest country in the whole world. It's got huge untapped natural resources, and much of it is very, very much open space that hasn't been colonized yet, let alone fully exploited. So what we see here is a situation where all the misery now we're getting from Trump's illegal war in Iran is on the back of a previous American establishment's meddling in Ukraine, which led to the disruption of energy flowing into Europe. So this is almost misery on top of misery that was already there. And it's leading to a situation where many countries like the UK, which were once very, very self-sufficient when it came to energy needs. We had a huge amount of coal, huge amount of natural gas. We had our own oil, the North Sea oil, which massively boosted the UK's economy in the 1980s. But all of that was essentially mothballed so that we could participate in the global economic system and buy our energy more cheaply elsewhere. And what we're seeing now, quite interestingly, is this huge problem of actually being part of the global economic community, because the global economic community works on the basis that everyone gets along and that the freedom of movement of goods and services isn't disrupted. And now we have possibly the greatest disruption of goods and services being moved, thanks to Donald Trump, thanks to Israel. This is on the back of the Ukrainian conflict. If this goes on, and if this war was dragged out and prices continue to rise, I mean, I don't know how long. I mean, it's been going for 19 days. I don't know how long it can go on for. I mean, potentially it can go on for years. I mean, look how long Iraq went on for. But if you had widespread disruption for months, potentially taking us into next winter, you could actually see large numbers of people dying all over Europe, especially pensioners, because they wouldn't be able to heat their homes. And we've already seen that in places like Britain. In places like Britain, we actually have a system of reporting that gives you the number of excess winter deaths. And excess winter deaths are seen as they average the number of deaths across the year. And then in winter, they measure the difference between the average number of deaths across the year and the number of deaths that take place in winter, and say they are excess winter deaths, which are usually elderly people dying due to adverse reactions to the cold, which in layman's terms means elderly people who can't afford to heat their homes. And it used to be a famous and well-worn piece of commentary that people would say, pensioners are now having to choose between heating their home and eating a proper meal. So you would choose to heat or eat. And I think this is going to be something that isn't just tabloid fodder that gets rolled out every now and again, but this is going to become a grim reality, not just for pensioners, but for a lot of normal working families.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no clear off-ramp in this conflict, so it's going to continue a lot longer, and people are going to suffer. Zog wasn't happy with just trying to get your sons to die for Israel. They decided your grandma has to die for Israel as well. You know, these white people, elderly white people, are going to die because of this. And it's an utterly insane strategy that they've had, you know, because essentially the Ukraine war was all about Israel and Jews as well. You had Ukraine, which was broken off when Russia was the Soviet Union, and the hatred which exists against Russia because of what the Soviets did to Ukraine when the Soviet Union was run by ethnic Jews. Then you have the Jew Zelensky gets in charge of Ukraine and uses that sentiment, which is misdirected because, you know, it was actually against what his people had done, and uses that to gin up the war. And it used to be that, you know, as you say, much of Europe, we got our gas and oil from Russia, and then Asia, they got their oil and gas from the Middle East. We were forced off of that by the Zionist occupation governments in America and in our own countries, who are just lapdogs of the American Zog. So we were forced into largely either getting our supplies from the Middle East or getting exorbitantly overpriced gas sent over in liquefied form from America. And now they've cut that off as well. So what is the supply for most of the world? These prices are just going to go up and up and up. And as I say, you know, the war in Ukraine, that was for Zog. It was also to get Russia out of Syria so that they could finally topple Assad's government. And they really thought that helped them to defeat Hezbollah and stop weapons getting into Palestine and Lebanon. It seems like that's not actually been as effective as they thought, because those groups are actively engaging now. But it's all for Israel. I don't think it's going to end for a while, because the resolve of the Iranian people is massive, and they just can't. The Americans and Israelis just can't achieve the war aims that they want to. So even if it's stopped now, if we could stop this war right now, the economic damage would still be coming. There was an impact on Qatar, I think, earlier today, which wiped out a huge source of natural gas, and they say it may take 5 years to get up to the capacity that they've just lost. But in order to get prices back down, we would need to exceed that, not just get back to where it is, because we're going to have this huge backlog of people who need fuel. So even if this war was to end today, those prices are going to be massively inflated for a long time. And, you know, the longer it continues, as I say, we're likely to see rationing, fuel rationing, and, you know, civil unrest all over Europe.
Well, it actually does get worse. So at the moment, we've been talking about the obvious costs of fuel. But today, the Daily Mail reported the following. This was released today, the 20th of March, 2026. Iran war unleashes mortgage shock for millions. Conflict escalation sees lenders pull deals as experts warn homeowners could see repayments rise. by £100 a month. Families could face 3 interest rate rises this year as the economic fallout from the Iran war begins to bite. The Bank of England warned yesterday that the growing conflict in the Middle East could send inflation spiraling and trigger a surge in unemployment, and any protracted shock could force it to put up rates. This would spell misery for millions of borrowers, with 3 base rate increases of 0.25 point adding around £100 a month to repayments on a £250,000 mortgage. And a £250,000 mortgage is about the average price of a home around the country today. So this would mean an extra £1,200 in mortgage repayments. And this is particularly important because the majority of adults in Britain own their own home. That is something that's the norm here. Home ownership is very, very important. And a large part of the British economy is built around the housing market, the sale of houses, and increases or perpetual increases in housing prices. But this could cause absolute misery and cause the housing market to stagnate, because if the prices of houses spiral immediately, or if there is a very, very quick shock to mortgage prices, and if this is true that lenders are pulling the best deals and denying future homeowners affordable mortgages, this could cause one of the major cogs in the UK economy to stop turning, leading not only to people potentially defaulting on their mortgage payments, because remember, their mortgages are going up, but at the same time, the price of everything else is going up. And at the same time, we're heading towards, Bank of England's words, not mine, a surge in unemployment. So people are not going to be earning the money they once were. We're seeing a transfer of people onto benefits, which will not be as much as they earned when they were in employment. This is almost like this convergence of catastrophes. You have high inflation, high fuel prices at the pump. You have massive inflationary pressures on your basket of groceries. You've got huge price hikes, sometimes a doubling of your fuel prices to heat your homes if you're living in certain parts of the UK where you use fuel oil. You are seeing a massive rise in mortgage rates, which could see over £1,000 a year on the average mortgage, and at the same time, a rise in unemployment, meaning it's harder for people to meet their outgoings because they are going to be shifted onto benefits rather than taking home a viable income. This is going to lead to a situation where many, many normal people, that band of what we call middle England that keeps the economy, keeps the country going, those are going to be the people that are hit really hard. Those are going to be the people that start to lose their homes. And we could potentially be on the cusp of an economic collapse that we haven't seen, or most of us haven't seen, in our lifetimes. I mean, the closest thing we have seen in recent history to this would be the winter of discontent in 1979. This could be absolutely catastrophic. And as Euro so rightfully said, and we'll move on to this as a separate issue in a second, the only way for Western governments to deal with this would be to begin rationing things like petrol and moving to extreme measures. They're already talking about speed limits in the UK, so people use less fuel. They're talking about longer working days. They're talking about a range of methods. So people would work for longer, maybe 3 or 4 days a week, rather than going into the office every day. We might see the return of work from home. We might see rationing of certain goods in the supermarket. And obviously, all of this is thanks to Jewish power and serving the needs of Israel. What do you think about this, Euro? I mean, obviously, if homeowners and the housing market takes a hit at the same time as everything else, and with the housing market playing such an important role in the UK economy, could we be seeing a once-in-a-lifetime economic catastrophe here?
Absolutely. I think it's going to be a global depression. You know, like the Great Depression that we had, I think, started in America and affected the world economy. this is going to be something that affects the world economy. And funnily enough, nations which have been under severe sanctions for decades, they're not as well integrated into the world economy. They won't have it quite so bad. Countries like Iran and Russia would be less badly affected by a world recession or world depression. The Chinese are more integrated into the world economy. They would suffer from it to a large degree, but the others, not so much. One thing I did want to mention as well, with regard to food prices and, you know, the price of everything going up because of transport, we don't produce very much of our own food in the UK. I mean, we do produce some staples, but things like fresh fruit and vegetables, a lot of that's grown abroad. So not just the cost of shipping within the country, but shipping across the continent, you know, like getting oranges and things from Spain to come to the UK, you know, that those things could become luxuries again. And as we said, these price increases with fuel are going to last for years, even if this thing ended right now. Obviously, we can't build power stations overnight. But if this continues for years, could we see the pits opening up again? You know, could we be sending people back into the coal mines because there's no other viable choice in the future?
Well, indeed, and what we've also not touched upon is the fact that most of the fertilizers used to produce the bumper crops that Europeans have been living off are based on petrochemicals. These are petrochemical fertilizers that require a constant flow of crude oil. They're produced from crude oil. So when you interrupt the flow of crude oil or increase the price of crude oil, you're not just increasing the cost of taking the goods or the vegetables from the field to the processing plant, then to the supermarket, you're actually affecting the growing of the vegetables, because most vegetables today are not organic. They're not grown in a traditional way. They're not grown in fields that are covered in manure. They're grown thanks to petrochemical fertilizers. So all of this is truly a massive catastrophe on so many levels. But the interesting thing is, we are seeing this incredible number of people, this mass awakening to Israeli power. Now, never before, I've been doing this 26 years, and never before have I seen so many normal people who are pretty much what I would class as normies or politically unaware. I mean, they're aware of who the main political parties are, and there's a left, there's a right, there's, well, I'm not really for more immigration, or I don't like the woke agenda. But all of a sudden, these people are talking about Israel. And you see this in the Daily Mail comments. A year or so ago, the Daily Mail comments section was either oblivious to Israel, or the commenters were so in favor of Israel, it was nauseating. Now, a year later, everyone's talking about Israel, and the majority are anti-Israel because of what's happening. Now, nationalists have spent probably even hundreds of years, trying to wake people up to this Jewish power structure. And all of a sudden, people are waking up. And they're not waking up because we've educated them about who owns the media. They're not waking up because we've educated them about who runs the porn industry, or who pushed feminism, or the powerful rabbis behind mass immigration. They're waking up because fuel prices have risen. They're waking up because they can't afford to buy minced beef at the supermarket. They're waking up because their mortgage rate has gone up so much that they are struggling to pay for the things that their family needs on a weekly basis. And what I'm saying is this the Great Awakening? Are we going to see more people waking up to Jewish power, not because of all the things that we've been talking about. Like, this for me, 26 years of talking about Jewish power, talking about mass immigration, talking about who owns the banks, who owns campaign finance, the power of AIPAC, human organ smuggling. I did a documentary on human organ smuggling. And all of a sudden, all of that has been completely eclipsed by the issue of 10p extra on a litre of petrol, or the doubling of, you know, fuel oil.
10p extra on your fuel over the time period of a month. I mean, that's only the start. It's going to go up and up and up. But for decades. Decades, I mean, you'll know better than I do, but I'm sure you've seen it, that for decades nationalists have said, you know, when it gets really bad, that's when people will wake up. But we've had this constant, like, boiling the frog thing going on, where everything just gets a little worse each year, and, you know, before too long you don't realize, you know, how quickly, how badly it's changed. But this is like such a sudden thing that it's like jolting people awake, because they've never seen anything like it before.
But it's not just a singular thing, is it? I mean, sorry to butt in, but we're not just seeing Israel meddling in our foreign affairs. We're not just seeing Israel pulling us into another war. This is on the back of what, months, years of watching Israel bomb children in Gaza, Israel starve people in the Middle East, war crimes take place in places like Lebanon. And I think there was a large-scale awakening from those who were left-leaning in terms of Israel's genocidal nature. That had soured a lot of people to the state of Israel. And even some of those on the right, I mean, you know, look at people like David Clouse from Unity News Network. At one point, David didn't really talk about the JQ, but one thing that really affected him when it came to the issue of Jewish power and Israeli control was these human rights abuses. So on one hand, the scales have fallen from people's eyes when it comes to Israel's human rights abuses and their blatant acts of genocide in Gaza. And at the same time, people who might not have been too bothered about that, or might have overlooked that, or might have been like, oh, well, who cares what happens to those people? They're just Muslims overseas. These people are now saying, well, actually, I do care about the extra 10p a litre for petrol. I do care about the fact my mortgage is going to cost me an extra £100 a month. So it seems like all sides at the moment, you know, the right, the left, and even the normies in the middle are waking up to Israel's power over the West and the terrible things Israel is doing. And Israel now is probably the least popular it's ever been. So you can tune into the Young Turks and they're anti-Israel. You can tune into Tucker Carlson and he's anti-Israel. And you can hear normies in the street saying, I don't want to go for war. I don't want to go to war for Israel. I don't want to go to war and die for these Jews. And I also don't want the price of a basket of goods to double because Benjamin Netanyahu's got a hard-on for bombing schoolgirls in Iran. This, to me, is very, very interesting. And I remember coming into nationalism a long time ago, and I remember people saying to me, Mark, things will never change. People will never wake up to the fundamentals unless they experience economic hardship. That's the jolt they need. Whilst they're comfy in their chairs, watching their sports ball with the central heating up at 25, a big spread of takeaway, you know, they've got the pizza, they've got the kebab meat and chips, a giant bottle of Coca-Cola next to them, their stuff in their face, their feet are up, everything's comfortable, you know, Man United are two up in the, you know, in the Europa League. And it's all easy, isn't it? You can draw your curtains and pretend that what's going on in the outside world doesn't affect you. And instead, that is changing. That's changing because you can't put on the central heating. You can't afford the takeaway because the takeaway just goes up and up in prices. That bottle of Coke, you used to buy a 2 litre bottle of Coke at the supermarket on the Super Saver deal for 95p, is now £3. The kebab meat and chips that was a cheap meal that you'd pick up on the way home for £6.50 in one of those styrofoam trays, that's now £11.95. You don't have Sky Sports anymore because you can't afford it because the heating is so much. And you don't have the heating on at 25 anymore. You put a blanket over your legs like your grandma and granddad used to. But people aren't used to the slightest bit of hardship. And for me, I mean, I discussed this a little bit with Adam Green on Wednesday. We had a bit of a debate about this because I said people need hardship. I said hardship and struggle in many ways is a beautiful thing because it sorts the wheat from the chaff and it forces us to confront problems within our society. And as many have said, economic turmoil precedes a mass awakening. It certainly did in Germany. It certainly was one of the major contributing factors to the decline and death of the Weimar Republic and the rise of nationalist governments all over Europe in that period. On that side, I was just going to say, yeah, I think is this going to be big, or am I being, or do we need, is this going to be big Euro? This is my final point. Is this going to be big, or is this, you know, because people aren't waking up, but are enough going to wake up, or are they going to get this back under control and we're going to need something even harsher to get people off their arses?
This is already massive and it's only going to get bigger, and it's massive in multiple ways. Obviously, it's massive in terms of the economic shocks that are going to affect everyone and make things harder. It's massive in terms of the amount of people waking up. It's massive in terms of shattering the illusion of invincibility of Zog. For the longest time, people have thought, you know, there's no way to defeat them. They're just too powerful. And it's showing now how fragile they really are. So that's something that's it's people are going to have to get used to. But also, you know, what's going on in Iran now, it kind of all follows on from October 7th, a few years ago now. Obviously, you have the idea that this was something that the Israelis let happen in order to justify their latest genocidal wars into Gaza. But this is kind of a direct follow-on from that. I don't think we would be having this war going on now, if not for October 7th, the genocidal assault on Gaza and the Iranians getting involved in that through their proxies, and the previous war between Iran and Israel.
I think you may be right. I mean, I've always said that, or I've said recently anyway, that I believe that October the 7th was something that was a genuine attack on Israel, but it was an attack that Israel allowed to go ahead. And specifically, I think Israel sort of funneled that attack against certain groups of people within their country to make a group of people that the current establishment didn't really like as essentially martyrs, get rid of them, and then use that as a reason for doing what they did in Gaza. But I think that was all part of a drive for the Greater Israel Project. I also think Ukraine was something that was started at the behest of Israel to suck Russia out of the region. Because at one point, I've been very honest about this, at one point, Russia was keeping Assad in power. And if you remember, Assad was on shaky ground several times before his regime was toppled. And at one point, sorry, mate, I keep saying that. I know Euro's going to bully me later for saying this. When we're off stream playing a bit of PUBG, he'll just be verbally abusing me as he always does. that's a joke because he doesn't actually do that. Probably maybe more me who goes down the route of the abusive friend. Anyway, with Ukraine, that sucked most of Russia's resources and military might out of Syria. And at one point, Assad was heavily, or it seemed heavily outnumbered, by numerous different terrorist-backed factions, including ISIS. And it was actually Russia that crushed ISIS in the Middle East. Trump tried to take the all the kudos for that. He tried to take all the glory, but it wasn't him. I remember at the time in the press, people were praising Putin and saying, oh, you know, Putin, many people in normie circles are saying, oh, Putin did what was necessary. He smashed ISIS in Syria. He drove the terrorists out. He prevented Christians being massacred in the region, which he did. But
and now the leader of Syria is a former ISIS member.
Exactly. And this is all part of Israel's plan, because Israel, I think, wanted the war in Ukraine. I think they wanted the war in Ukraine for several reasons. One of them was that immediately on the outbreak of the conflict, nearly every single civilian Jew, and when I say civilian Jew, I don't mean members of the government who stayed there, but civilian Jews in Ukraine fled to Israel, which is what Israel wants. They want more Jews emigrating into Israel, and they want them there so they can expand settlements in places like the West Bank. That helped Israel immensely. And then also, Russia eventually suffered more losses than they hoped to. That was largely because of American and European aid flowing into Ukraine. That caused Russian resources to thin. So Russian bases in places like Syria were emptied. Russian troops were moved to Ukraine. And that allowed Israel to arm and to give information to al-Nusra Front, which is the rebranded al-Qaeda in Syria. And essentially, Israel helped a bunch of cutthroat terrorists topple Assad's government. Assad fled, and now you've got a bunch of head choppers in charge in Syria. That's what normal people wouldn't want, but it's what Israel does want. So when you look at many of these problems, they all flow back to Israel. Now, I'm not saying Israel were the driving force behind the conflict in the Ukraine, but a very, very Jewish incarnation of the American State Department run by what's her name?
Victoria Nuland.
Yeah, that's it. Victoria Nuland, real name Noodleberg or something like that. That's her, you know, they changed their names. Their real name's something like Noodleberg. Run by Victoria Nuland, were behind that aggressive policy making which caused the outbreak of that conflict. So when you look at all of this, all roads seem to lead back to Israel. And this is a group of different calamities, all converging, all thanks to Israel, and essentially all serving the Greater Israel Project at our expense. And if not directly at our expense, definitely to our detriment.
Well, they say that all roads lead to Rome, but in reality, all roads lead to Tel Aviv. You say that Israel was supporting ISIS, but actually ISIS was wholly a creation of Western Zog-controlled intelligence agencies. The whole thing was set up as a way to attack Russia and Russia's proxies, such as Syria, in the Middle East. And to the extent that it caused massive terrorist attacks within Europe itself, the people who set it up, they didn't really mind so much, as long as it didn't upset, you know, upset the Europeans too much. It had to be managed, of course, but, you know, they were just happy for more dead Europeans. But what I will say is, thinking back to when ISIS was attacking things in Europe, there was kind of a palpable feeling. There was something going on where you felt like, if this continues, things are going to have to change. Even amongst the normal people, you know, people who weren't that engaged with politics, when that was going on, people were like, yeah, this can't continue. Something's going to have to change. And you said about, you know, obviously this economic hardship. Look at what happened when there was economic hardship in Greece. Obviously, Zionists and Zionist occupied governments have expended huge amounts of energy in order to shut down Golden Dawn and criminalize their existence and put the whole leadership in jail. But Golden Dawn had a massive surge in popularity in Greece during their times of economic hardship. And now there's a huge opportunity for nationalists to take advantage of the chaos that our enemies have created and that our enemies have created, and they've also shown their hand. So we have the opportunity during economic crisis to come to the forefront and say, these are the people who've created the problem. They're still making it worse now, and we have the solution. And although I don't think it's necessarily going to happen, I think what would be the best case scenario is by the time of the next election in the UK, which is going to come no later than August 2029, I believe, we'll see a massive growth of Restore Britain, because people have seen that reform is Tory 2.0, and that not only did they staff the entire their entire shadow cabinet with former Tories who were instrumental in bringing about mass migration into UK and continuing those problems, but they supported this war. Now they've had a bit of a U-turn and they say, oh, actually, you know, we're not in favor of it so much anymore. But in the beginning, they were wholly supporting it, whereas Rupert Lowe and Restore Britain were not.
Well, that's interesting, and I'm pleased you brought this up. By the way, thank you to the chat. It wasn't Noodleberg or Noodlestein, it was Noodleman. Thank you for people who, I got that wrong. I added a Berg rather than a man. Probably a bit of a stab in the dark there for me. So thank you for correcting me on that. But this is one of the most interesting things about this. And this is kind of, we've talked about people waking up. We've talked obviously about normies talking about the power that Israel has. And I think Euro just made an excellent point that Nigel Farage at first was all behind this war, and now he's not. And he's not because he can see that many of the people who support him are not behind this war. And he can see that this hasn't been the big vote winner and the big popularity boost that he might have initially thought at first, you know, jump on board the Trump train, get on board with the MAGAPEDs, you know, we will ensure that we stand by our American allies and all that sort of nonsense. He thought that was going to be a big winner, and it hasn't been. Now, this is kind of the fly in the ointment here. And I think we do have to raise this point because it's very, very important. Now, we've talked about the Weimar Republic and the fact the Weimar Republic collapsed, and the Weimar Republic collapsed due to both social and economic reasons. But the Weimar Republic was absolutely a haven for liberals, degenerates, leftists, and for people that nationalists did not support. And the nationalists were the counterbalance to the powers that be, or the powers that ruled the Weimar Republic. So that put the nationalists in Germany in a very, very good position. And at the same time, there was economic problems in a very, very liberal Europe, which again put fascist nationalistic parties at odds with the people who were presiding over a system that was clearly in decline, giving people a good reason to vote for nationalist alternatives. Now, interestingly, this is an issue, because what has actually caused this? Yes, it was Israel. Yes, a lot of people are waking up to Israel. But undeniably, MAGA, American populism, and specifically Donald Trump, are central to this problem. Now, you can argue that it's their slavish devotion to Jewish power, Israel, AIPAC, etc., that has brought us here. But this isn't like the Weimar Republic in the sense that that was ruled by the left. It was ruled by liberals. It was ruled by these utter degenerates. This, to the people, is a problem created in many ways by a right-wing populist government. And one of the kind of counterbalances to all the good things I've said earlier is, will this potentially sour people to voting for populist right-wing alternatives? Because it appears, from a normie point of view, that populist right-wing alternatives are leading to these economic conditions that could destroy the quality of life for the middle class all over the Western world.
Yeah, I just hope that, as I say, you know, people in this country are ready to kind of take that fight forward and take advantage of this situation. And, you know, things are going to be bad, but what holds back people from Europe taking their own destiny into their hands is the Zionist power in the American Empire that's controlling them. And because of the massive amount of noticing that's going on before the economic hardship and now, you know, exacerbated because of it, it really provides an opportunity that Europe may have to have a kind of separation from this American empire. I mean, not wholly, but to take a bit more of their own path and decide things themselves. But even just looking back at, you know, America threatening to take part of Denmark's territory, a NATO ally, that's something that got a lot of people thinking, this is a crazy situation. We can't rely on the Americans to defend us anymore. And this is something that's politically going to push. It's going to push Europe and America apart. And that might be just what we need so that we can take control of our own destiny, because whilst they have that hold over us, we never can.
Well, I agree. And I think it might have different effects in Europe to America. I think in America, it's obviously going to give a massive boost to the Democrats in the midterms. I think populism will be seen as a failed experiment in America. However, here in the UK, here in Europe, I think this will be a pushback against the American power structure. And I think it'll be another nail in NATO's coffin. And I've said many times before that I believe that the American establishment must fall and America's control over Europe must end. And I think that is something that, you know, I've said consistently. It's something I absolutely do believe in. And I think fundamentally, we need to push at that door. We need to push this issue, and we need to push this issue, because if we don't push this issue, we're going to miss this once in a generational, once in a lifetime opportunity to break America's stranglehold over Europe, which post Second World War has done nothing but reduce the levels of ethnocentrism in Europe and push degeneracy upon our people. So I think this is a time where we should be looking towards opportunities and towards our countries in Europe, our European nations, regaining control over their own foreign and domestic policy and breaking away from America. But I think for America, the consequences are going to be that MAGA is going to be damaged. And I think MAGA, to wrap up, and we're coming to the end here, guys, MAGA has now become this... somebody said today, it's not actually my words, I'm going to read this, I think I'm going to read directly from the tweet that I shared. It might have been yesterday I shared it, actually, but I thought it was an extremely good tweet. I didn't write it. a guy called Chris Burnett wrote it, and he said, MAGA is completely 100% utterly dead. MAGA is now just a zombie skin suit worn by Mark Levine, Bill Ackman, Barry Weiss, Jared Kushner, Captive Dreamer, Ben Shapiro, Douglas Murray, Chris Rufo, Mark Dubovitz, Shabos Kestenbaum, and he goes on and on and on. And that's true. MAGA is dead. All that remains of MAGA is this zombie corpse controlled by Jewish power. It's no longer a movement of normal Americans that have had enough. And I hope the same doesn't occur in Europe. I hope Europe does break free. Do you have any thoughts on that, Euro, before we go to the super chats? And if anyone wants to super chat, you can super chat through Entropy or through Rumble. And thank you to everyone who listened, and we'll answer the super chats next.
Yeah, the Zionist-controlled American empire can't end soon enough. I mean, what is that saying the Americans have? It's like, America is a rotting corpse. Two sides are fighting over it. One side is rooting for the maggots, and the other side is rooting for the corpse. But, you know, it's the only thing that will allow us to take control of our own destiny. And we need to be proactive. We need to be trying to get ourselves into Restore Britain, I think, and pushing that as much as possible, because that's the big thing. I mean, it's funny that, you know, within the last sort of year, you were saying there's no point trying to start our own micro party and run things along in that way when Reform have shot up massively, and they're the big thing that's out there. They're going to be dominating politics for the next couple of election cycles at most. And then within the blink of an eye, they're already falling. They're already sliding out of that. I mean, it looked like if we had had an election a couple of months ago, they would have swept into power, but they're already on the downswing. And people like Rupert Lowe and his organization are coming up, and we need to take advantage of volatility. We need to take advantage of the dire circumstances that are being forced upon our people.
Well, I'm not quite on the same page as you about Reform's collapse. I think, you know, a lot of these opinion polls say different things week in, week out, and we'll have to wait and see till see what happens at a general election. I've seen Nigel Farage being written off many times before, only to come back with a vengeance. And the council elections are coming up. I mean, it's March now, so there's only really 6 weeks more campaigning until the next round of council elections, which takes place on Thursday, the 7th of May. So that will be an interesting gauge of how things really are. Anyway, let's do the super chats. And we have had a few. Thank you so much for those who have super chatted. Thank you so much for those who've been very generous tonight. I genuinely appreciate it. And if you haven't super chatted and want to ask something, I'll answer it now. Caribou gave $7. Thank you so much. Said apologies for the late dono. Hello, Mark. Adam seemed not to know about Vatican 2.0. Yeah, I'd like to ask Adam Green about that, and I'd like to talk to him more about Christianity. So thank you for that. Nationless Nationalist gave $3. Thank you so much, and said, appreciate your work. Well, I appreciate your continued support. Thank you so much. Four Camarade gave $3. Thank you so much. Said, evening, Mark. Euro, the tables have turned, not by Jesus, but by the hands of yet more influenced megalomaniacs. The end of days are liked by some, Jews and Christianity. Are we getting close to the end of days? Oh, I'll answer this first by saying I don't think so. I don't think we're getting close to the end yet. I think when collapses happen, it's so when you read history books and you read about the collapse of empires, because you're reading it in a history book, it seems to happen very quickly. But when you look at, say, the collapse of Rome, there were actually two collapses. There was the collapse of Rome, and then there was the Eastern Roman Empire in Constantinople. And after Rome had collapsed, that continued on for quite a period of time before that too collapsed. But that didn't actually collapse. That was militarily conquered by what went on to be by the Ottomans, which went on to become modern day Turkey. So you do have collapses but they don't take place over a very short period. And I think one thing that nationalists often think is that a collapse will, you'll wake up, you know, January the 3rd, economic turmoil on the horizon, and by February the 4th, complete collapse has now occurred. By March the 10th, well, you know, we're back now, guys, and there's been a revolution. Rarely do things happen that quickly. And when you look at mighty empires collapsing, it can take decades or even hundreds of years for that collapse to take place. And if you look at the British Empire was struck a fatal blow from within. At the time of the Second World War, Churchill was so desperate to take us into war that we won a Pyrrhic victory, where fundamentally our actions during that war led to the decline and destruction of our own empire. And looking at where we are today, the decline and destruction of the British Empire didn't happen in 1945. The seeds were sown in the 1940s for the destruction of the empire, but the actual collapse of the empire is fundamentally still taking place now, with what's left of the Commonwealth and the inward immigration that we are experiencing because of that failed empire. But it took decades for the empire to collapse, and that collapse is still ongoing. What do you think about that, Euro? Are we in the end times, heading to the end times, or are we living in this slow, drawn out and protracted collapse that may take decades or even centuries?
Well, everything's in flux. I mean, nothing ever happens until it happens, and then it was inevitable. It was always going to happen in that way. You know, you can't say when those points are going to be. There are so many points throughout history where something could have happened if there was just that little bit more of a push. You know, there's events where things turn on the smallest decision, and there are events that passed us by and they didn't happen by the smallest of decision, and we just don't know. There's that other quote, isn't there? There's decades where nothing happens, and there's weeks where decades happen. And these are the weeks when decades are happening.
Very well put, my friend. Herb Derp gave an incredibly generous $200. Thank you so much. He said, been mean to give money to people like you for a while now. Keep up the good work. Well, thank you so much, my friend. It's very much appreciated. And remember, I do genuinely appreciate it. And I am not just a content creator. I'm not somebody who just sits making multiple hour-long streams per week and talking about problems. I am somebody who is out on the street, out demonstrating, out building real-world organizations. So thank you so much for your generous donation. Solar Mass gave $20. Thank you so much. It's a great discussion. Thank you. Well, thank you, my friend. And Crafty Booms gave $14. Thank you so much, and said, for the order of the torch, illuminate the sky. Well, thank you so much. Not many questions tonight, but some very generous super chats, which I really, really appreciate. And if you want to super chat, you still can, and you can donate any time, whether I am live or whether I am offline, and I appreciate it all the same. So thank you so much to everyone who donated tonight. It is very, very much appreciated, and I can't thank you enough. Euro, that brings us to the end of the show. Do you want to say a quick good night, and we'll wrap things up?
Yeah, I've enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on, and I'm sure I'll be back on your show again soon at the next opportunity.
You certainly will, my friend. I want to thank everyone for being here tonight. Thank you to everyone who was live in the chat. We had about 250 people watching across both platforms. Thank you to all those who were here, and thank you to everyone who donated so generously. I will be back on Sunday night, hopefully for a film review with Laura Towler as the special guest. I'm looking forward to that one. And if not, I will see you on Wednesday, and I've got Mike Enoch on the show. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you to Euro. Thank you to everyone who donated. Thank you to everyone who tuned in. See you all again soon. Have a great weekend.